I'm Larry Morrow, and this is Take Two, the radio program that looks inside a person's adventure, not so much from the outside in, but the inside out. In the next 30 minutes, you will discover the inward joy of their heart that married them to the passion of their life and the affirmation of ideals that directed their success. Well, folks, it was 33 years, 22 days on June 17th of 1988 that my special guest today, Mike Swiger, arranged a meeting for his brother and his brother's roommate. The end result was his brother beat the roommate to death, which made Mike an accomplice. Mike would spend the next 17 years behind bars. When the cell door slammed shut, the clanging shattered Mike's life. After 3 years, he was told he would get out, but denied. After 10 years, he was told by his lawyer, "Have your family pick you up in the morning. You're going home." The next morning, the first phone call from his lawyer said, "Mike, denied." 3 years later, after 17 years in prison and being accused of aggravated murder with death specification, and the thought that the state of Ohio had planned to electrocute him, he was granted parole for being illegally detained for 15 years. Well, in part one of our interview, we briefly touched on your writing career, Mike, which started when you were in prison. I just finished reading, as you well know, which drove me crazy, To Kill a Saint, which I couldn't put down, as you know. And Mike, please forgive me the comparison, but you remind me of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, who both started off as insatiably curious thinkers. That curiosity led them to become inventors with very different results. You, too, are a very curious thinker. Mike, welcome to part two of our interview. Good to be with you again.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's always a privilege to be with you, Larry.
Yeah. I hope you didn't mind this comparison.
I think it's a stretch.
Mike, let's talk about To Kill a Saint. It started out, we don't have to give all details, but was that your fourth book?
That was my fifth novel.
Your fifth novel.
It's my third one set in Cleveland, and it was about secret societies. You know, I like to get into controversial things, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. And secret societies are always a part of conspiracy theories, but they also seem to rear their heads sometimes. So I invented one for this book based on a true secret society. And as you see, it's very suspenseful. I like to write very fast-paced, short chapters, twisty, turny mystery thrillers. And it seemed like I achieved my goal as I was getting texts from you as you were reading that the last few weeks.
You know what? To be honest with you, I don't read books like that. And I read mostly leadership books and speaking books, as you well know. But that book drove me crazy because I read my Bible before I go to bed at night. And so I would go like this. I'd read 5 minutes of my Bible and then 30 minutes of Mike Swiger. And Rosie said, "Shouldn't that be the other way around?"
Well, thank you. I'm glad it entertained you. I'm glad it kept your attention.
Mike, I understand you are one of only two Ohio prisoners to ever be professionally published while incarcerated. Who is the other?
The other was a man named William Sidney Porter, who was published 100 years before me, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
He was incarcerated at the Ohio Penitentiary for embezzlement. And during his time there, he wrote 14 short stories under several different pen names. But the one he became best known for was O. Henry. one of America's most prolific, well-known short story writers. So I was blessed to join good company.
Mike, explain to our listeners how a short story you wrote led to your first job after you were released from prison.
I was at Trumbull Correctional Institution at the time. We had a volunteer named John Schmidt came in who had just come back from the Holy Land. And he was telling us about his tour. And he said that he had stood in the cell that was believed where Barabbas was kept right before Jesus' trial before Pontius Pilate. And as he was sharing the story and what he thought Barabbas could see and hear, it inspired me to write a story on the crucifixion as told through the eyes of Barabbas. Because I figured if anybody knew that Barabbas, that Jesus died in his place, it was Barabbas, as that cross that Jesus was hung on was built for Barabbas. So I wrote this short story. I sent it off to the War Crime magazine. And about 6 weeks later, they sent me a letter accepting my story with a check for $300. which for a little four-page story was, I thought, a lot of money. And every month, the magazine would come to our chapel, and I would open up the magazine, look for my story, and it was never published. So 6 years later, I get out of prison, as you mentioned, in 2006, and I start applying for jobs around Cleveland. And there was a job open at the Salvation Army, their district headquarters in Cleveland, for an IT position. So I went down, I filled out my job application, and I turned into security guard, and he's looking at the application. And the very first line says, "Have you ever been convicted of a felony? Check yes or no." So I checked yes. And then they give you a line about 2 inches long and says, "Please explain." So all I wrote down was, "I will explain during the interview." So I hand my application in, the guard starts staring at me, and I don't want to have a staring contest with the guy. So I pick up the April 2006 War Cry magazine, and I flip open to the center story, and it's my story.
Wow.
I wrote the story 6 years earlier from prison, and it was published a week of my job interview at that company. So I go into my job interview, and the HR lady's grilling me about all the things I did in prison. And the last thing I had on my resume, I said I was a published author. And she goes, "Yeah, right. Do you have any samples of anything you've written?" And I handed her the magazine. I said, "I'm the feature story in your international magazine this week." And they gave me the job. So it led to my first job.
And now, as we fast forward, your legal thriller, Lethal Ambition, just became, too bad we don't have a drum roll, just became the number one bestseller on Amazon for Black and African-American Christian fiction. But you are not Black. How did that happen?
Yeah, that is definitely ironic. I spent half my life in prison, as you know, and I became very, very dear friends. Some of the closest people to me on planet Earth are African-American. And during my time in prison, I really were surrounded by people who were confronted with racial issues. And it's not hard to see that in prison, the vast majority of the people are African-American, which is in disproportion to the population in general. You know, and asking the question, why is there such mass incarceration? I started reading the writings of Dr. Walter Williams. He's a distinguished economist from George Mason. He's an African-American. He just passed away in December. I started reading the writings of a former Black Panther named Jesse Lee Peterson, who became a minister. And I started seeing that there was this mass incarceration and the destruction of the African-American family. It didn't happen by accident. These were policies that our government put in place, starting with Johnson's Great Society. Walter Williams said that Johnson did in the Great Society what slavery, Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws couldn't do, which was destroy the African-American family. This continued through policies, through President Clinton's crime bill back in 1996, authored by President Joe Biden now, that led to an explosion of mass incarceration for African-Americans. So I was just puzzled by, why are these policies by one party supported by the very people who are being harmed by this party? So I wrote the novel Lethal Ambition to deal with these political issues. I wrote it 20 years ago. It was published 13 years ago, re-released just in December, with the timing being very, very pivotal because, as you know, racial issues are exploding across the country and have been for the last couple of years. So the book has certainly resonated. It's challenging people to look at the racial issues and the politics behind them differently.
Well, you must pinch yourself every once in a while to think, is all of this going on? Could it really be going on?
Yeah, it's strange. You know, when just this past Sunday night, it went from number two to number one on the bestseller list. And my wife and I are taking screen captures of the book and taking pictures of it on our from the Amazon page. And it does seem surreal. And, you know, I think I mentioned to you once before I went to prison, I'd never read a novel all the way through.
And you were reading comic books.
I was. And now I've had the privilege to write several. And it's very gratifying to see people read them and challenge people. I get lots of emails from people who've just really invested in the characters and or have questions about the plot. So it is surreal. It still doesn't seem real that my book's at the top of the bestseller list.
Mike, in a case where truth is stranger than fiction, I understand your own life followed the plot of your book closer than you would have liked.
Indeed. Lethal Ambition, my protagonist is an elderly gentleman. He's in his 70s, and his wife is struggling with breast cancer. And she was misdiagnosed at Cleveland Clinic, and she received her treatment at University Hospital. And I wrote that in 2000, the first draft. And then in 2010, my own wife was misdiagnosed at Cleveland Clinic and went through her treatment at the University Hospital. So unfortunately, I had to live what my protagonist experienced in his book. And had I known I had that kind of prophetic ability, I would have had my main character win the lottery.
Mike, we are living in a very strange time. Today happens to be 1 year ago that a very not famous person was murdered, which changed America, as you well know.
Yeah.
Racial tensions are at a fever pitch in America, so your book is timely. What caused you to wade into this controversial area at this time?
Well, it's my belief that there's only one race. It's the human race, and it's based on the Bible. God created one man, and from that one man, all men came. Mm-hmm. All of us share one blood. The distinctions between us, whether it's eye color, skin color, height, or physical characteristics, and dividing people by physical characteristics is a man-made distinction. What I teach my children, it's never right to criticize anybody for how they look, but you can challenge how they think or the ideas they put forward. So I wanted to challenge people in a work of fiction to think differently about race, think about ways we could come together, overcome some of these challenges. And you know, I think back to Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, Harry mm-hmm. Beecher Stowe, a Caucasian woman from Cincinnati, Ohio, wanted to get involved. And she did it through the media of fiction. Fiction entertains. And first and foremost, I try to, as you saw from To Kill a Saint, I try to entertain. I try to engage the reader. I try to trick them to keep the suspense building. But at the same time, I'm trying to challenge ideas and bring, of course, new perspectives for my readers. So the timing was certainly God's providence because, as I said, the book had been out of print for a couple of years and just re-released this past December.
Mike, the time that we have spent together has been so incredibly rewarding, not only for myself, but for many people who are wondering and curious. I mean, you spent 17 years in prison. What was that like, Mike? Can you give us any idea on how someone as young as you were to spend 17 years in prison for something you did not do or you were accused of? What was that like, Mike?
Prison is its own world. It has its own social mores, and it was a culture shock to me, of course. Prison is very regimented, and unlike what people think, prison is a lonely place, even though you're never alone. You know, you wake up every day, and your number one priority is to keep yourself safe. It's a very violent place, and you're trying to compete for security and safety against everybody else in there. And it's a world that you wake up with stress level at very fever pitch. You know, I know you did interviews in Vietnam back in the 1970s. You were in combat zones. You know, I know you're a Marine, and thank you for your service, Larry. So you've been around people who spent their life at high, high anxiety levels. And that's how prison is. People wake up at, you know, DEFCON 4 every day, and they just try to survive. So for me, I focused on learning. I never had a television when I was in prison. I wanted to use the one commodity God gave me, which was time, to my advantage. So I was always reading, always trying to learn. I was trying to do every day with coming home in mind so I could be equipped to be a better person, to someday be a good father, someday be a good husband, and to contribute. But yeah, prison's like nowhere else on earth.
You know, while you were there, Mike, you probably saw every social issue you can imagine. Yeah. Do you write about other social hot topics?
I do. The first thing I started writing about was abortion. You know, it's a very hot topic, as you know. Mm-hmm. My belief is that, you know, life begins at conception. But even in our own laws, there's so much contradiction that doesn't seem to make sense. So the first book I actually wrote, it's called A Trial of Innocence. The plot revolves around a female prosecutor who had once had an abortion herself, who is seeking a death penalty against a handicapped man accused of killing an unborn baby because he assaulted a pregnant woman. And I thought, well, why is it okay for her to try to put the death penalty on somebody who had done the exact same thing she did? So when you see these ironies in the law, I try to expose them through fiction. Another book I wrote was called A Murder of Innocence, dealing with the craziness in Ohio, American laws. In America, it's against the law to kill an unborn eagle, but it's certainly legal to kill humans. Those kind of ironies, even if you don't believe that we're a special act of creation, which I do, and that we're made in God's image, which I do. If we were all the same, humans and animals the same, why wouldn't a human have the same protections as an animal? So I addressed that in A Murder of Innocence. And then Lethal Objection, which is another Cleveland-based novel, deals with a wrongful death case. And it kind of wades into the water of the emotional toll this whole industry has on its providers and the women who go through them. And those are all, you know, Agatha Christie, John Grisham-style murder mystery legal thrillers. But I try to use that medium to bring apart some different perspectives.
You're listening to Larry Morrow, Take Two, and my very special guest is Mike Swiger, who is the executive director of True Freedom Ministries. Mike, in your line of work, you must meet some very, very interesting people. What is the most dramatic transformation you've seen in a prisoner's life?
Without a doubt, that was a man named Petey Brown. Petey Brown was from East Cleveland. He was a really rough drug dealer, Golden Glove fighter, just a vicious man. You know, I spent my life in prison avoiding him to make sure I was nowhere near him, just for my own personal safety. I had watched him savagely beat people up over very minor offenses. So I avoided Petey Brown at all costs. Years later, I had the opportunity to share the gospel with him in his cell. And I walked through the presentation of what it takes to become a Christian. He made a profession of faith, and I told him, you need to read your Bible, you need to go to church, you need to get baptized. And I walked away fully believing that he had just humored me. He was just trying to get rid of me. But about a week later, he showed up at my cell door, and he was holding the Bible. It was a King James Bible. And he said, you told me I should read the Bible. I don't understand this. Do you have an easier one to read? So I gave him an NIV, and off he went. And I thought, wow, that's something. And then a week later, he showed up again. He said, I don't understand this book. Can you teach me this book? So we started getting together once a week in the day room in front of the whole cell block. You know, the biggest gangster thug in the prison and this little white Bible thumper getting together for Bible study. And after 6 months, he asked me a question that I promise you no other minister that you know has ever been asked. He looked at me and said, do you think it's wrong that I sell dope? I said, yeah, it is, Petey. And he said, I won't do it anymore. And he stopped. Yeah. And over the next 3 years, he became the biggest sweetheart of a man you ever met. And he became my best friend. We worked out together. We spent all of our time together. And years later, both of our securities jumped in minimum security. And we were transferred to an honor prison together. And by this time, he was just a humble, meek guy. Still big, still worked out, but just a humble guy. And we were working out, and this little guy pushed in front of us, and Petey stepped back, and the kid looked at him and says, you better get out of my way. Petey looked at him. He looked at me. He said, he just don't know, do we? He said, you better be thankful. I love Jesus Christ. Petey got out. He got married and just got a job, just an incredible transformation. So, with the job that I do, I get the privilege of watching lives change like that.
But the Bible will do that, won't it, Mike?
Changed my life, and I know it changed yours.
And mine as well. Yeah, while you were in prison, you founded True Freedom. True Freedom has grown to be Ohio's largest prison ministry and has been nationally recognized as an innovator in prisoner ministry and reentry. What are some initiatives that you've piloted through your time there, Mike?
Well, one of the things we see as ourselves, as our vision and mission for prison ministry, is we don't stop assisting until the person we've been ministering to during his incarceration is home with a job supporting his own family. And one of the biggest challenges people have is when they got out of prison is getting a job. You know, in America right now, there's over 2 million people incarcerated. 10,000 get released every week across the country. And here's a staggering statistic. 67% will go back to prison within 3 years. And the unemployment rate for ex-offenders is 75%. So clearly, not being able to find a job and be able to support yourself and your family leads people to going back to prison. So a few years ago, we piloted a program that would enable us to take people out of prison during their last 6 months of incarceration, place them into externships at private companies, free of charge to the employer, with the objective of getting people real world experience, being able to get on the job training so they could build their resume, getting real job evaluations, real feedback from employers, and then be able to have some capital they can use in their own reentry. So we launched in 2018. The prison system allows us to do this. We're the only group in Ohio that can do this. We take prisoners out of prison. We launched with a group of women from the women's prison in Cleveland, and we took them to the Virgil Brown building where they run what we call the Second Chance Cafe. And then in 2018, we started doing that in private restaurants And the first restaurant we took the ladies to work in was the Marble Room downtown. You know, as you know, the most opulent restaurant in Cleveland. 2 weeks after we were there was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Cleveland. So the restaurant was filled with rock and roll celebrities. And one of the ladies that went through our program got to wait on John Bon Jovi. So she got back to the prison that night and talked about that story. We had lots of interest in our program. But we've expanded to the trades, to manufacturing, to logistics. And before COVID, we had 60 people go through, get out of prison, get hired immediately by the employers that they had externships with. And we had 100% job retention. So the program is working.
You know, Mike, for those that may have missed our interview last week, we spent 30 minutes talking about what happens to one when they get out of prison. One of the stories that moved me the most, I was there to hear the gentleman talk about it, was got out of prison. You got him clothes from what you have your own clothing store, you know, for the prisoners to get out to wear clothes. Then you got him a job. And I said, how did you get back and forth the job? He said, I didn't have a car. They came to pick me up and take me to and from work. That was a wonderful story, Mike. That happens every day.
It does. You know, one of the things that we call it the great paradox. You know, you can't buy a car unless you have a job, but you can't get a job unless you have a car to get there. Yep. So one of the things that we do is we provide transportation. We bridge the gap until they're able to have their own car. So we have a fleet of vans. So we pick up people at halfway houses, transitional housing centers. We drive them to their work site. We pick them up at the end of their shift, bring them back home until they're able to have their own car. And then we help them buy their cars as well. So we're trying to address that problem of being able to get transportation until they're able to afford it themselves. You know, you mentioned our clothing store. The only cost to the items is you have to have been a prisoner. It's free. But it's run by a gentleman named Dave Sudnick. And you've seen it, how meticulously it's organized.
Yes.
And that's his whole ministry. He collects used clothing. He sizes it, makes it available. We pass out over 10,000 garments a year through that shelter you've seen.
Wow. What is the most important piece of the recovery process? I mean, there are probably a million of them, but what is the most important part, Mike, of the recovery process?
For me, it's an internal transformation of heart, putting your faith in Jesus Christ. Without a transformation of your heart, you're only working on the externals. In what I find out, especially people who have addiction issues, is unless their heart's been transformed, the first time life gets hard, they will run back to their addiction. Mm-hmm. So the transformation of the hearts is essential. But beyond that, you have to have a desire to change, then accountability. You know, life is a participation sport. None of us go through it solo. We need people around us. And we provide aftercare and accountability. We have weekly meetings in the inner city of Cleveland. We do try to partner people up with what we refer to as a mentor, not necessarily a sponsor, to help them basically live life together. So transformation of heart and having accountability are two key ingredients to successful reentry.
Mike, what happens when addiction is chronic, progressive, and let's characterize it as simply undoable? And we've all seen those kinds of people. What happens then?
Yeah, that was a big change in my thinking. There's a big argument and debate in the whole addiction recovery area. Is addiction a disease or is it a sin? Mm-hmm. And I was at a presentation done by a neurosurgeon who said, the first time someone uses a substance, it's a choice. After it changes your biochemistry, it's now a disease. And he was showing MRIs of brains of people who have been long-term heroin addicts, for instance, 10 years. And you see these images of this, a brain that looks like mad cow disease. Mm-hmm. And he said, if this gentleman gets clean and sober, those holes don't get filled back in. You know, his thought process is never going to be the same as it was before. So with this whole epidemic of opioids across the country, we are creating a whole generation of people who have a different baseline of normal. We have to learn how to adapt to that, encourage them to meet their fullest potential. But we as a society, we need to recognize this is a disease and the impacts of it are real and it's physical.
Now, Mike, during this interview, you have probably mentioned the Bible 15 or 20 times. The Bible and society, as we all know it, is in direct conflict. Struggle and doubt is a dangerous journey, and many of us have been on that journey. You know, you can mess up one's mind but not his soul. The greatest desire of a leader is to unlock the potential in others. Do you feel that you've done that?
I've been privileged to influence people over the years based on my faith. I just got a text today from a gentleman who'd been out 5 years, and I haven't heard from him in probably 3 or 4. And all he said was, "Thank you so very much for helping me get out of prison. You changed my life." Wow. So I've had the privilege to give people and let them borrow my belief in them before they have belief in themselves. I see incredible potential in the men and women I work with. And a lot of times they just need the opportunity to convince themselves they can actually succeed.
Well, this has been a wonderful journey that we've been on for a while. So, Mike Swiger, what can I say? But thank you so much, and continue the great work that you're doing with True Freedom Ministries.
Thank you so very much for having me on. And thank you for your friendship.
Larry Morrow, Take Two, will be back next time with TV personality Tim Taylor. And until next time, do all the good you can to everyone you can, every time you can. For Take Two, I'm Larry Morrow.